Welcome to Imperfect Leaders, where the world's most admired leaders are willing to be totally vulnerable. In today's episode, we ask some simple but profound questions. What does it take to solve some of the world's nastiest problems, like hunger, poverty, and awful diseases that impact people around the world? I can't think of a better person to ask for perspective than today's guest, Rich DiTizio, who's the CEO of the global think tank, the Milken Institute. Before the term psychological safety was even fashionable, the Milken Institute was already putting incredibly smart and talented people into a room together, asking them to set aside their egos and work together towards a common vision. And Rich, he's the symphony conductor. He gets people to work together to make beautiful music and to hopefully make the world a better place. It's an incredibly important leadership skill. So sit back, and I hope you'll enjoy today's episode. There's no doubt you're the CEO of one of the most impactful and most interesting think tanks in the entire world. Let's start off. What exactly is the Milken Institute, and how do you make the world a better place?
So the Milken Institute is primarily a financial think and action tank. I would say it's not just a think tank because we're less involved in research and more involved in activating different programs globally. So I would look at it, we are divided into three primary areas of content, which we call pillars, and those would be finance, health, and philanthropy. So through those three pillars, we tend to take a multi-prismatic view of a lot of the world's problems, because often many things stretch across all three and are not just resonant in just health or finance. And I think a good example to illustrate our work really comes right out of COVID. So if you think about COVID as it unfolded, it was a novel virus the world had never seen before. But what started out as a health issue and crisis very quickly morphed into a financial one. So if you think about the earliest days of COVID, when there was no remedy or potential vaccine in the offing, we really needed to get PPE out to the fields. And that really fell squarely into the philanthropic community. And philanthropic capital tends to be the most agile capital there is, because it doesn't need a board meeting. We don't have to have a congressional review. It's someone's individual money or foundations that can activate that money in the direction they choose. So they were very instrumental in funding the distribution of a lot of the equipment early on. And then luckily, we had the mRNA technology already. And since the virus was mapped and everyone was able to download the genetic code all over the world, you had hundreds of universities and medical centers working on potential cures and vaccines. And the earliest iterations, you might recall, of the vaccine required it be kept at sub-zero temperatures. So now you think, well, the philanthropic community doesn't have refrigerated cars or trucks, but the business community does. Mm. And with the early success of the virus was great, but no one had billions of glass vials or needles or anything else laying around. So we really had to lean heavily into the logistics and manufacturing capabilities of corporations. And at the same time, since everybody was home, we really had to start thinking about, well, what should the fiscal stimulus be, and how are we going to create safety nets for people who could no longer go to work? And so we really were advising through our finance leg a lot of governments, both locally at the state level, federally, and then different governments around the world. And there were very different types of response, which we were monitoring. At the same time, our health area was really tracking about 300 different potential cures and vaccines that were in development. And as luck would have it, we were able to then not require the refrigeration anymore. But then you started to see, when there was some success and the virus was still rampant, we really needed to lean into governments, because they had the mass capabilities and distribution, and we needed to make it free for everyone. So it really was this balance of the philanthropic community stepping in first, then the business community getting engaged because they had the manufacturing capabilities. And you'll recall that people were manufacturing each other's formulas. For a moment, we were just avoiding any kind of competition. For once, the one thing I did see through the business community, governments, et cetera, is that it was almost as though Earth was attacked by Mars, right? We had a common enemy, and we were able to drop any predispositions or competitive nature in order to all come together and start rowing towards a solution. As you know, we have a series of programming conferences around the world. Mm-hmm. And I think that those, whether it's the largest one we have here in Los Angeles, which is 5,000 people in the spring, or we'll do smaller events of about 1,000 or 1,500 in the Middle East, in Singapore, et cetera. I think when you give people the safe space to debate an issue without judgment, you find the ability to come up with innovative solutions. And that's what we're trying to do. So we are a neutral arbiter. We're nonpartisan. We're nonpolitical. What we're trying to do is tee up problems that we think have workable solutions in the offing, and then task the people that have the technical proficiency to address those. So I think it's very often, and the nice thing about what we do here is we can bring people from both parties, different types of companies who may be quite competitive in their day-to-day encounters. But when they're under our umbrella in a more social setting, where sometimes it's off the record, sometimes on, but we give people an opportunity to kind of be truthful. And then you can really surface what the issue is and start working on it.
I don't want to put you on the spot, Rich, but I kind of do. Can you give me an example of how you actually created a safe space where you say you have a Republican and a Democrat, or somebody, you know, two CEOs of companies that are fierce competitors? How do you actually create the environment that's a safe space for people to feel comfortable, you know, sharing ideas that are probably very much conflicting with one another?
I think I'll start on the political realm first. So as a nonpartisan entity in the United States, anyway, we are trying to always have representation from both parties in an issue. And if they're coming to our conference to speak, there are a number of social engagements attendant with that. So dinners, luncheons, the like. And what we'll try to do is, in a very calculated way, is seat people who think they hate each other next to each other. Huh. And I think one of the interesting strategy about that is almost like a wedding. If you put you're a table number four or table number six on a card as someone enters the room, they're going to go where they're seated. And then when they see the person, I think what is, as a person who hasn't spent a lot of time in Washington, what people who have tell me is that years ago, people who were representing their districts would actually move to Washington, D.C. So you were from whatever state you were from, but you actually moved your family to the Capitol. And therefore, there was a social bond created because your kids played Little League with your ostensible opponent's kids, et cetera. So people actually had much more knowledge of one another as people, as opposed to just their ideologies. Today, that's been flipped. So people literally stay where they are and then fly into the district for votes and then return. So they never have an occasion to have any social interaction with the people on the other side. So we forge those social things. And I think it's interesting for me to watch, because even people who ostensibly think they hate each other but don't really know one another will invariably find some sort of common denominator. Like your kid plays soccer, my kid plays soccer. And then listening to those conversations, you start to build some social capital. And I think that social capital is critically important, because people you know in a social context, you are less likely to be as aggressive with. And I think that creating those bonds, and you see it, unfortunately, they tend not to be as present in today's Congress, which everyone has to pick a side. But we're hoping that if we focus people on the issue that everyone benefits from, we can distill some of that down to a reasonable way. We do that in a couple of ways. But if you start to talk, like, there's no opposite side to some of the things we work on. Like, nobody's pro-cancer, right? Everybody wants to find a solution. Nobody's pro-child poverty. Nobody wants to see one more kid get shot. But when you start to wrap it in the politicization of just about everything like we do, you can actually quell some of the people who actually have something interesting to say. So what we'll do is our conferences tend to have both public sessions where people are on stage and presenting their perspectives around an issue. But then we'll also curate from that more private sessions, which are more roll up your sleeves, people really trying to get tactical and in the weeds on an issue. And in those sessions, I think you really get people to kind of happily disagree, but do it in a respectful manner and focus on the solution.
Well, let's talk about some of the issues, you know, the big meaty issues that you guys are working on. You know, one that comes to mind, faster cures. How does your organization help remove some of the roadblocks to important innovations in medicine and healthcare? I mean, you talked about COVID earlier, but is there another example of how you remove roadblocks to, say, chronic disease or something else that affects so many people in the world?
Sure. So, and I think this goes back to why having diverse perspectives around the same issue is important. So why finance people like myself putting it being in a room where people are discussing issues around health that seem to be unmanageable is important. So right now there's about 10,000 diseases which are known to man. Only about 500 or so have any work whatsoever being done on them. And part of that equation is that in the United States, just like it's been for decades, it costs about $2 billion for each new drug or therapy to get across the transom and 17 years. So unless you have a potential patient population at the end of that journey, both the financial journey and the time journey, you're just not going to spend a lot of time if you're a company that's developing a therapy. So a lot of diseases go untended because we haven't really democratized the access to the financial complexity of putting other diseases through. So I think that this is what some of the promise of AI and technology is affording, because it would be essentially disease agnostic. So you'll see one more cancer treatment or one more diabetes treatment because most people are going to get those. But the orphan diseases, which would be those that have less than, say, 250,000 people, and many of those are not that rare. They're diseases that you and I know, like cystic fibrosis, et cetera. Just not enough people have it to make economic sense for a company to invest so heavily in it, particularly when the lab really has such a high failure rate, right? You're asking people to go in struggling day after day with a 90%+ failure rate to hope that some molecule is going to generate something. And I think what we're trying to do is apply some of the finance principles into the space. So when I go into these meetings, I can say, listen, you just told me it takes 17 years to develop a drug, yet everyone at the NIH is on an annual budget. That makes no sense. That would be like me calling your mortgage every year. We're not really giving you a 30-year mortgage. We're going to come back every year and you're going to have to beg for it. And then you're tasking people who are super capable scientists with spending time going out and trying to fundraise to keep their labs going. It's a broken process. And I think what we're trying to do is say, if we can borrow some principles from finance, like risk pools and shared risk and distribution, couldn't we get more money towards more research? And so we're starting to move the needle. And so between that and advances in technology, where you're seeing things like the notion of synthetic clinical trials, right? So maybe I don't have to wait 7 years using AI or a combination of AI and clinicians, we can maybe expedite some of these. So I think that we've also been thinking, again, more on the finance side, but a lot of pharma companies have many, many molecules on the shelf that didn't demonstrate success for the initial implication they were trying to target. But they had some success, but they just didn't have enough to kind of put it in the queue and start the $2 billion process. So what we're trying to do is go into those companies and say, if you kind of unleash those into a pool, almost like a mutual fund, and then we could access capital to start re-energizing the funding and the processes around that, we can then maybe capture a little bit more success on the disease front. So by mixing up kind of the health and the finance, I think we're unleashing a new level of innovation around how to fund it, because the paradigm is already there that it takes such a long time and so much money.
And what about, tell me a little bit more about how AI and machine learning play a role. So if, you know, several of the different companies have molecules sitting on their shelves and that, you know, they don't worry too much about the IP regimes, you know, they share that with you. How does technology help?
We've seen the first spinal cord paralysis victim walk because the electronic signals from your brain were able to bypass your spine and to a sensor that was in your leg. So I think you're seeing mobility issues that by putting sensors in different parts of your body and bypassing the part of your nervous system that's broken. We can do that. You're seeing things like there's a system called Loop for diabetes where you don't have to prick yourself anymore. Actually, your phone will tell you and monitor constantly your insulin levels. So that kind of changes young parents with young children with diabetes. It's been a game changer for them. So I think this notion of kind of moving into technology for some of the solutions, not all of them, is going to portend a great upswing in the level of cures for all sorts of things.
Let me switch topics, because I know you also work a lot on the American dream. What is the American dream, and how does your organization help people achieve it?
So we are in the throes of constructing what will be the Milken Center for Advancing the American Dream in Washington, D.C. So there will be a physical premises there of a number of buildings on our campus, really to understand like why people don't feel like the American Dream is theirs anymore. So highlighting people whose success they feel has achieved the American Dream, giving people tools to figure out what it is they want from for themselves and their families. And then really kind of understand this notion that it's eroding in some way, and really stop that. Because for such a long time, it has been a beacon of hope around the world. And as I travel around the world, it still is in many respects, although I would say it's broken. And people's perception of America, whether it's its moral leadership or financial leadership, tends to be on thinner ice than it once was. But I think that we're trying to create not to distill down for everyone what their dream should be, but just give them a quilt from which they can find where they fit and something that feels right to them. So we're doing it, wrapping it in hope and optimism, but also realism that not everyone has had an equal shot at the American dream and hoping to level the playing field. I think I'm not sure it's a systemic problem so much as a notion that's in trouble. I think that people, for a very long time, those who would say they've achieved the American dream tended to be one type of person, right? Whether sometimes they were immigrants that came and had success, but a lot of the structures inside the United States were designed for straight white people. And I think by systemic racism is clear. You know, we redlined people from purchasing homes or having mortgages that could be bought. You know, I think there's a lot of things that have happened in the past that we need to address going forward. But you can see why, if you were coming from a disadvantaged perspective, this notion of what the American dream might be seems a little bit out of reach for you. So what we're trying to do is say, what are the kinds of things that we can address what happened in the past or not? It's and then figure out like how do we level the playing field going forward? So I think we're hopeful that it becomes a place where people can come and find careers that they may have never thought of before. You know, we'll highlight different types of industries that maybe they didn't know about. We're leaning heavily into technology, so we're taping 10,000 different people from different careers and paths of life who are thinking about what the American dream meant to them, and you'll be able to like watch snippets of that and hopefully inspire yourself.
That's so cool. Aging. How do you help the world think about and prepare for this massive population of aging?
Aging is a worldwide issue. So I think many countries are aging and aging rapidly, right? The United States, Japan, Italy. Africa is the youngest continent in the world. In some countries, the average age is 15. So you think about the parts of the world that have historically been the economic drivers are aging, and parts of the world that are emerging are young. So there seems to be a little bit of a mismatch there. I think aging is very complex. So on the one hand, a lot of the advances against many diseases that you used to die from, you know, cancer used to be a death sentence, AIDS, most people died from, you know, today through advances in treatments, we're able to say you live with a disease instead of die from it. But that doesn't change the fact that we haven't really figured out how we're going to sustain all of these people. So if you think about a place like Japan, Japan has a declining and very aging population. When they devised their pension, the largest pension fund in Japan was for a very long time restricted from investing in anything but Japanese fixed income securities. Those securities, until very recently, earned essentially zero. So you had none of the actuarial assumptions you made from a financial return perspective when these funds were created materialized. At the same time, you have people that have a relatively healthy diet to start with. Some advances in medicine have even prolonged that life expectancy. So you have people that are living far longer than you thought, and your existing pension pool never made as much money as you thought. So you have this yawning gap of way more people to sustain off less money. And that is a phenomenon that you see around the world. So as we think about that issue, you know, part of our global view is to say, okay, can we develop capital markets in parts of the world where they're either non-existent or in very nascent stages to digest some of this capital and deploy it in a way that maybe can get some outsized returns. So you have the mutual benefit of creating an economy and lifting people out of poverty locally, in places like Africa, where we do a lot of work in sub-Saharan Africa, and then get some return into these funds because the people are not dying as quickly as you thought, and they're going to need these funds to help them sustain their lives. So when we think about the work that, and we have done now in concert with the IFC and the World Bank, we've run about 200 mid-career finance ministry professionals from various African nations through a program that creates a cohort about capital market development. Mm-hmm. And that is, you know, because some countries might be too small to have their own fixed income or equity market. But when we think in a pan-regional way, we can create cohorts of people that are trained in capital market development and creating a financial infrastructure that allows companies and capital to feel safe deploying there. So we think of aging in, on a number of fronts, but we are concerned that some of the advances in health broadly will keep your body alive, but we haven't really cracked the nut on Alzheimer's. So we are nervous that we're going to have a bunch of older adult kind of healthy people that are going to need very different living arrangements and the like. So we're working on creating some financial modeling for that.
And how do you measure success for something like that?
I mean, it's a challenge. I think that what we're trying to do, this issue is in many countries. It's all sorts of participants that are trying to tackle it. We're hoping to give people at least a guidebook on some of the things that we want to try. Mm-hmm. And I think that what we're thinking is this is a long-term, decades-long systemic issue. The success will be when people are, we talk about health span, right, instead of lifespan. So if we can keep people healthier longer, the net expense of them goes down, but then they also have more productive, healthier lives. So if we can kind of, instead of decades of sickness, shorten that so that you might live longer, but you're actually going to live more healthfully as well, then the expense of that also goes down. So it has a mutual benefit.
Yeah, and it sounds like it's pretty hard to measure like the ROI because it is such a long-term time. But when you think about mental health, you know, what are you guys doing around that?
I don't think people know that depression is the number one cause of disability in the United States. And you've heard the Surgeon General recently talk about loneliness as an epidemic. So, and loneliness has the negative physical consequences as smoking. So we have this kind of odd confluence of mental health issues, which were only exacerbated by COVID. So once people went home, and you couldn't see your family, and you know, a lot of, particularly older people, were really struggling with mental health issues around being so alone. The other thing that we're seeing is that you now are having a cohort of people entering the workforce, the first cohort of people who have actually had active shooter drills when they were children. So this notion of how can corporations be ready for the mental health implications of that? And this kind of cohort that's now graduating college and coming into the workplace, what are we going to do to ready ourselves for that? So I think this notion of, and the debate over in the office, at home, again, I would, you know, caveat that by saying not everyone has that luxury. I mean, most people don't in the world. They have to actually go to the place of their employment. But for those that do, it only exacerbates this notion of being lonely. Because even though I think I have a relationship, I'm just by myself in my apartment sometimes. And that's been very hard for CEOs to address. So I think that's been one of the challenges that we've been helping them think through.
What is your policy at Mokin? I know it's not a huge company in terms of number of people, but what is your policy?
So we've gone to a hybrid, like most. We're 3 days in the office and then two from home at the person's option. If you want to come in 5 days, you can.
And by the way, if I had your office in Santa Monica overlooking the ocean or right by the ocean, I'd be in there for I'd be there 7 days a week.
I think there's also, when I speak to other CEOs of far larger organizations, this notion of the erosion of culture comes up a lot. And the idea of mentorship and watching people senior in the office and adopting some of their behaviors and strategies that younger people used to be as just part of a training. You know, you were in the room with people who had been seeing similar problems or just been in the same line of work for such a long time. So I think we've yet to see that manifest. Certainly technology enables us to work remotely, and I'm talking to you right now and seeing you on over Zoom, right? So I think all of those have been quite helpful, but I think that when couple the loneliness, the lack of a real culture, you know, younger people used to like join a company and go out for happy hour, there's a social component to it as well. As that becomes more fractured and companies are more diffuse, I think it's hard to kind of corral it into what is the culture of this place.
You know, what kinds of leadership skills do you need to run an organization like Milken that's literally changing the world? I mean, we've talked about such meaty issues and we haven't even talked about the environment or, you know, how philanthropy is changing. So there are so many other things that you guys do. You know, what are some of the skills that you need to be the CEO of an institution like Milken?
One, I would say being an active listener is important. And I think that people think they are. People think because they're hearing, they're actually listening. But there's a great book called Fierce Conversations by Susan Scott. And in it, there's a line where you can't say something you don't already know. And if you just think about that, people in sales in particular, but leaders also, tend to occupy all the silent space with words, like constantly talking. And what they should be doing is asking questions. Because you can't, one person, I can't possibly know everything that's going on in our global footprint around the world. Mm-hmm. But I need to understand what I need to know, and I can only find that through asking the right questions. And I'll give you a couple of examples that I think work. Is you, when you're talking to your team, you need to say, like, what is the most important thing you and I should be talking about? Because I can't assume that I know what that is because I haven't been in our Abu Dhabi office or Tokyo or right. And so when I get there, I'd like to know like what is the most important thing you are struggling with or working on? And then I can think through how I might be able to help it. I also think that, as I was saying before, I think a leader's primary dimension is emotional. The thing that I can do, because I can't be involved in every report or convene every panel that we're on, I said, but people are looking to me for the transmission of mood, and I understand that. So how I responded to COVID was I panicked. Like, how did I feel about our financial state and how we were going to survive that? I'm sensitive to the fact that my mood has resonance. And I think that's the second thing I would say is that good leaders that I've observed over my career have that notion of a wake, right? Like, what is the wake they're leaving behind? And how do people act when they're not in the room? Mm-hmm. So I think that by setting the culture, and it goes back to why I'm concerned that it's becoming a little bit diffuse in many organizations, people buy into the culture if they feel that they're aligned with the way the leader sees it. And people want to feel valued for doing the work that they do. So I think that what I can do from this seat is be helpful on team construction. Mm-hmm. So I think that when I think about how teams come together, mm-hmm. There's two things I would say on that. Like one, I'm a very big Myers-Briggs person. Mm-hmm. So I think that when you go through the Myers-Briggs type indicator, it is telling people what their natural predisposition is. Right. So if you think of the science,
from a personality point of view.
Yeah, but it's actually a little bit more in science, right? So when someone's born, you have about 100 billion neurons, and then your brain refines the connections to the ones that you most frequently use so that by age, you know, 15 or 16, you've already determined like which connections are established. And then those connections are unique to you. And it, those tend to show up in kind of your Myers-Briggs. It's like not necessarily, there's no right or wrong or good or bad. It's just, this is how you naturally approach the world, the way you take in information, the way you evaluate decision-making.
And so just for the listeners, so one of the aspects or dimensions on Myers-Briggs might be an introvert versus an extrovert.
Correct. And in that context, introversion and extroversion is really, where are you getting your energy from? Mm-hmm. So it isn't that I'm more social at a cocktail party, it's that extroverts tend to get energized by being in large groups of people. Introverts can recharge their batteries by themselves. And I think it's important. One, it's a skill set that you can learn. Not that you want to change yourself. What you want to do is ascertain another person's Myers-Briggs as best you can. And when I go back to thinking about team construction, what ends up happening in most organizations is that when you meet a person who reflects the same Myers-Briggs that you have, those interviews go splendidly well. And you end up hiring a person because they reflect back to you, even in a subconscious way, the very things you like about yourself.
Is that good or bad?
It's okay. It's bad if you keep doing it, because what you do, if you were to do that time and time again across your whole team, what you end up doing is you become marginally better at something that you're already predisposed to be good at, and your gap widens. So the things that you're not good at gets even wider. So what you have to force yourself to do in thinking about team construction is lean into hiring those people who actually have a different skill set on how they make decisions and how they take in information, because you already know how you do it, even if you're not conscious of it. And I think that's a little bit hard. And that's why leaders tend to replicate themselves. So when I think about even like why are we literally 50 plus years into what I'll call kind of the women's movement about equal pay and, you know, gender parity, how are we still talking about this? So why is it not done? And I think it's because even subconsciously, people replicate themselves into roles. And then you create a management pipeline of people who look just like you. And what we need to do in order to kind of force a change is be very deliberate about how you populate the people around you. And sometimes that's not going to feel great because those interviews aren't going to go as well. But you have to make yourself force that decision so the benefit of the team.
Well, what are you? Are you an introvert or an extrovert? You're a guy that literally flies in three countries in a week. So, you know, you would think that you're this, extroverted, charismatic CEO flying around the world. But are you?
My Myers-Briggs is an ENFP. So, yes. So an E is extroversion. So my lean is to that, but I'm not 100% extroversion. I definitely have some I to it where I need some time to kind of recalibrate. N is between intuitive and sensing, is how you take in information. Sensing is when you take it in, just like it says, through your five senses. So if I read it, if I see it, if I hear it, I take that in as a truth. N people, which I am, are more intuitive. So I like the tone of someone's talking. They're much more like sensitive to the emotion and less sensitive to exactly what the facts are. That's not always good, right? So I think that there's no good or bad. But for me, I'm 100% N. That's not always great.
Especially as a hardcore finance guy in your background.
Right. So and then the next letter F and T, feeling or thinking, it's kind of the lens you run data through. So thinking people use analytical frameworks to come out with a black and white yes or no, one or two formula. Feeling people are concerned about the emotional damage or uplift that might
what
be
are
happening
you there
the
again?
Decision. You say again?
And what are you on that one again?
F. Yeah, so ENFP. And then P and J, so whether you're perceiving or judging. J people actually they love formulaic things. They have lists all the time. They're black and white. They definitely want a structure. J people are very attracted to structure. P people are more using their imagination. They're late usually for events, you know, because time isn't like as definitive as a J person would see it. And maybe more creative in the way they think about things that are unstructured. So in combination, right, because there's four different letters, there's a ton of different combinations, each one has a profile. And I think if you can quickly ascertain even two or three letters of the person that you're speaking to, you can adapt your speaking style into the way they best are going to receive it. And I think that's really the skill. When I say it's a skill you can develop, it's because my natural predisposition is going to be like very heavy E, for example. But if someone in the office I know is an I, me going into the office every day and like talking for 20 minutes is going to make them not as productive. And they're not going to say it because they're I. So you have to be sensitive to how other people are taking in the info.
Might that also inform whether or not, you know, you want to meet with them face to face in person or over a beer or over Zoom or over an email because they feel more comfortable expressing themselves, you know, in writing?
Yes, absolutely. And I think too often existing corporate structures are really only making room for one type or two types of people. And people come in all different types. And if you're just more thoughtful about that person's perspective, you can maximize what it is they want to do. And this I would also say is that people tend to lean towards the parts of their job they like the best. Mm-hmm. And the entire performance appraisal structure is designed to kind of beat you over the head for the things that you're not particularly good at. So it celebrates the things that you're good at, but it also, because the detail of all the tasks you're expected to accomplish might be wider, you're always going to have some negative feedback. What I think we can do differently is to say, what are all the tasks an organization has to do? Let's find the people that actually enjoy those and really would lean very heavily into those and just make that their job. And then find someone else that does the components of the job that they're not particularly adept at, because the likelihood is that they don't like it and they don't have the skill to do it. So we may as well find someone else.
So your philosophy is that they should lean into what they're good at and then try to have a talent management system that lets everyone do what they're good at. What about those stretching them outside of their comfort zone and, you know, trying to get them to build skills that they don't naturally have? Or is that not quite as important?
We spend a lot of time trying to do that, and I'm not sure it's always as productive.
Why not?
I think you're better off enhancing the skill set of somebody who's already good at something to be great at it, as opposed to trying to get something that they're poor at and hate doing to a mediocre level. And if you just thought of a workplace where people were coming in every day and they both enjoyed the work they were doing and they were good at it, that would tend to be much more highly productive people. We also, even in the scheme of things, we tend to spend way more time on the people who are underperforming. So if you think about now, we're coming towards the end of the year, all around the world, companies will be doing the performance appraisals, et cetera. The people who fall into not performing very well will have plans around their improvement developed. Somebody's going to monitor it. We're going to spend months and months and lots of time in HR and the line manager trying to fix the person who's broken at what they do, at the expense of enhancing and pushing even further the people who are already really good at what they do into greatness. And I think organizations do this all the time. And it's I really see it as a mistake. You're putting your chips on the wrong number.
And does that go back to your billions of neurons in the brain making connections by the time you're 15 or 16? I mean, it's going to be very difficult to change the way people think and behave and what they're interested in, especially, you know, by the time they're in their 30s or 40s.
Correct. And that's what I'm saying. I think it's a lot of wasted time because you're trying to like beat someone into submission on something that they just are not going to get good at, or they can like passably get okay at it, but you're actually better off making the person who already is good at it even better at it and then finding a new role for the other person.
And what about innovation? You know, doesn't that depend on getting a lot of people in the same room, just like you do at Milk and events where you bring in outside experts? Don't you need to do that internally where you get people that think differently, that have different interests, that have different skills, kind of in a room together, exchanging ideas? Is that difficult? Because earlier you said, as human beings, we sort of want to hire people that remind us of our favorite person, ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. If we have any little magic sauce here at Milken, it really is putting people with diverse perspectives in a room, because the people, and I see that as the example I gave before, putting like me as a finance guy in a room where they're tackling a health issue, it's because I've never seen the health issue, but I have my own framework of analyzing problems. And since most people who are in tackling the health issue tend to be scientists or the like, they know how they think, right? And that's why people get stuck in a loop, because they struggle with the same thing and they don't come up with an innovative solution because the same types of people are thinking about the problem. If you insert somebody who's never thought about the problem into it, they bring a very different framework of how they look at issues. And I think that really becomes the genesis of innovation.
I love it. And what kinds of things do you look for when you're considering hiring, you know, a great new talent into the organization? Maybe it's a new scientist. And obviously, you know, you're looking for the technical skills and scientific ability, but what about some of the softer skills or values do you look for?
You know, it's interesting. like having run a bank and now running a nonprofit, when you run a bank, particularly at a public company like Citi was, you get a report card all the time, right? Certainly on a quarterly basis because we're reporting earnings, but I ran a business that was largely asset management and market dependent. Like I could on a daily basis push the button and see what flows were, what the markets had done, et cetera. So you're constantly in the feedback loop. When you're tackling much more complex issues, you know, poverty, hunger, disease, right? It's harder. No one comes and taps you on the shoulder and says, hey, great job today. So I think part of it is the person needs to have a spirit of their own inner accomplishment, because there isn't going to be an external feedback loop to tell you that, yeah, great, cancer's cured today. That's just not likely to happen. But the notion that the work itself is moving the ball down the field and I can get some satisfaction out of that is really part of a trait that I look for. And people want to participate. I think the nice thing is, I would say that even in the for-profit corporate space, this new generation is much more about aligning their personal value system with the value system of the organizations at which they work. Mm-hmm. And I think part of that is becoming productive societally. Like, does this organization do something that's solving some issue that society has, whether it's on the environment or disease? And the other thing I look for is, and it's hard sometimes in the interview process to tell this, but is someone resilient? And I think in this issue, because of the issues we tackle, there can be a lot of sadness, right? So I was just last week, we did a forum on gun violence up in San Francisco. And you can become kind of overwhelmed with the complexity and sadness of some of these issues. So you need people who can be resilient enough to say, yes, it's challenging, but I'm going to lend what talents I have towards a potential solution. And that's the harder part. Because to your point, the people's proficiencies, they can go to great schools, they've had great jobs before, that's kind of the easy part. It's that other softer skill that's a little hard to figure out.
So how do you tell if someone's resilient? And I know that you already told me it's difficult, but what process do you go through to figure out if somebody hits a roadblock or somebody is discouraged that they're going to bounce back or they're actually going to be even more motivated?
The one question I always ask people is like, what is the trait you most dislike in other people? And I think I don't really care what the answer is. I'm concerned with, one, how quickly they answer, right? Because if you don't know that, you should probably. But it's also, it's the reflecting that they're doing is giving me a little bit of an insight, right? Because again, I'm in the fortunate position, both at Citi and here, we have very competent people applying, right? So from their resumes, they're super smart and they've done wonderful things. And it's two parts of that question. One, like, do you seem sincere when you're telling me that? Mm-hmm. Right. Because everybody's going to say, well, I hate liars or whatever it is like this. But then the why is what I'm really more curious about. I don't want someone coming, lending their technical skills and then being frustrated because they're not getting the end goal that they want, which is a cure for a disease or what have you.
Yep. How did you end up at Milken?
So I ran the private bank at Citi, which when an organization that large, like everything from the branch on the corner all the way up to the private bank. So it was essentially the wealthiest people on the planet, right? So it wasn't a traditional banking environment where people are coming to the bank for you to help them get rich. You've already set the bar that you already had to be that. So it was really much more about the complexity of navigating all of that money. So a lot of that became people thinking dispositively, like, what am I going to do with it? Am I going to leave it all to my children? Is that going to mess them up? Like, how do I think about those types of issues? And unfortunately, that cohort of people does have a disproportionately high instance of suicides, chemical and substance dependencies, et cetera. So really thinking the people who have most of what the rest of the world wants, which is a lot of money, end up having a lot of attendant issues, which aren't so great. So that visibility, in some odd way, people who are in this private banking sector have seen this movie hundreds of times, right? So I think that people tend to be the wealthiest person they know, particularly in that cohort, but they really are not ready for what comes after it. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's the whole notion of the erosion of trust, which unfolds, right? Because once you have so much money, you're never really sure why someone's dating you or why someone's talking to you, right? Because there's always this underlying, and I think particularly in first generation wealth creators, because that they didn't have it to start, right? So there was no like sense that the person that they married all those years ago didn't love them because they didn't have any money when they got married. And now for their own children, they have a very different set of worries. Mm-hmm. So in trying to figure out like, well, how am I going to navigate this? Because again, it goes back to like what we're talking about, skill sets. Mm-hmm. People who would come to an organization like Citibank, right? Obviously, they assume the technical proficiency resides there. There's 300,000 people, you're in 100 countries. Like, they're not questioning whether you can help them navigate markets. What they really wanted was, can you help me navigate the problems that are going to come with all this money? Mm-hmm. And when a person, particularly in the second generation, when you're going to inherit more money than you're ever going to make on your own accord, it's very difficult for you to have an independent self-identity away from the money. So in an effort to figure out how do I craft some sort of identity that's about the kid, I leaned into philanthropy. So using that as a mechanism for that second and third and subsequent generations to say, okay, we're going to change the dynamic from what money can buy to what money can do. Mm-hmm. And then that the do part can be totally about you. Mm-hmm. So whatever your passion is, you want to be in the hospital or animals, whatever it might be, you can then put your stamp on like activating this capital in a way that has something to do with you and not really your parents who made all the money. Mm-hmm. And it gave this cohort a sense of identity away from the shadow that the parents or grandparents had created. Mm-hmm. And then since I'd worked so much in philanthropy, both from the bank's perspective of like when you're in that position, you are also on the board as an organization like Citi is donating its own capital, right? So helping those organizations figure out how they can be successful. But then also, since everyone had a private foundation, public charities in that private banking space, it was like kind of a quick learning over 25 years. But and then I thought to myself that because I had been in the space for a quarter of a century, that I should probably do something else and maybe in the nonprofit space. And then, the Institute was very center of the plate because it was finance as kind of a core. And Mike was eager to expand globally.
So did Mike reach out to you or vice versa?
We met through a mutual friend he's very convincing.
And briefly, we haven't even talked about the great legendary Mike Milken at all. Well, how did he start this organization in the first place? What was his rationale?
Well, he had been on his own health journey as a prostate cancer survivor, and then also obviously keenly interested in financial markets over his career. So I think he felt this notion that there was something to do. And part of it was when he was diagnosed with prostate cancer, I think he wanted to know when the drugs and protocols they were prescribing him had been developed. And he found out they were developed like decades earlier. And he thought, well, what's gone on since then? And I think in his curiosity, realized not all that much, and then created something called CapCure, which ended up breaking into the Prostate Cancer Foundation for prostate cancer specific funding and faster cures, which is more disease agnostic across all diseases. And trying to do exactly what I said is apply some principles that come out of other disciplines like finance into the medical research ecosystem to see if we couldn't move the needle. He couldn't move the needle a little bit.
And definitely talking about Mike's journey is a whole different podcast, but what is his and your vision going forward for the next 5 to 10 years? What would you like to see Milken become?
I think we continue to expand our global footprint. I think that as I travel the world, many of the issues are the same in a lot of the world. I think the nice thing I take away is that many of the positive things are the same because I'm walking around different streets, whether it's in Sao Paulo or Singapore or wherever. Children out there playing, laughing, parents love their kids regardless of the government that they live under. I think there's notions that we can all use as touchstones to what creates a more positive life. And I think our tagline here is that we're building meaningful lives. Mm-hmm. And you can't have that if you're worried about your health all the time. And you can't have that if you're worried about not having any money to pay your bills all the time. Mm-hmm. So I think what we're trying to do is, between those two facets of kind of the health and finance, allow people to feel like they have some productive life and they're doing something they want to do.
A lot of young listeners, especially that are tuned into this podcast, are very much, you know, values-based, mission-oriented leaders or up-and-coming leaders. What's your advice to them, you know, the young leaders who want to make a positive impact in the world, but maybe feel a little bit overwhelmed?
So I, you know, primarily ran a sales force for a very long time at Citi. And I would, at our various meetings, I would go on the stage and say, okay, everyone needs to find their cartwheel. And people say, what does that mean? I said, well, if I on this stage were to do a cartwheel, you wouldn't remember anything else I said, but you would remember that that little guy did a cartwheel on the stage. I said, and you have to figure out what yours is, because there's too much competition. There's too many different types of careers you can have. You may as well pick one that you like. And if you pick one that you like, you will likely be very good at it, and that will be your cartwheel. And then people will remember you because you were so passionate about this thing that you now call your career.
I love that. And I guarantee you, if I did a cartwheel on stage, there would be an ambulance coming. Rich, this has been phenomenal. Thank you so much for spending some time with us today. We really, really appreciate your insight and your vulnerability.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Imperfect Leaders. If you have a question for our guest, feel free to reach out at www.imperfectleaders.com. Until then, we'll see you next week.